and welcome to 30 Brave Minutes, a podcast of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. In 30 Brave Minutes, we'll give you something interesting to think about. Today, your host, Jeff Frederick, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, is joined by Drs. Caitlin Campbell, Deborah Hamner, and Darren Nelson. Their topic, soil.
Of all the critical elements of daily life, perhaps we are least cognizant of the importance of soil. We are in many ways oblivious to the role of soil in our lives, preferring to walk on grass or sidewalk rather than engage it directly. We receive the occasional scolding from our moms for tracking it into our living rooms or for caking it onto our jeans. What Little League mom hasn't thrown up her hands with the Rubik's Cube-like challenge of removing orange clay from the knees and backsides of lily white baseball pants? Soil has been crudely and derisively dubbed dirt, a major sign of disrespect given all the greatness that soil provides as a great and underappreciated ecosystem. In fact, soil is multi-talented. It provides a built-in water filtration system, an ability to trap and hold huge amounts of water and prevent more flooding from becoming even more routine. Soil is biodiverse. It's home to as many or more living organisms in a generous handful than there are people on the planet. It also provides habitat for air, carbon dioxide, the previously mentioned water, plants, animals, minerals, rock, clay, silt, sand, and a host of describable and indescribable organic matter. Soil is artistic, appearing in red, orange, brown, black, gray, and even yellowish hues. And soil has distinctive textures. It interacts and adapts in response to climate. It plays host to all things living and dead, and these living and dead forms and decaying matter shape and then change the soil itself. It can be smooth or loose, packed or sandy, mucky or sticky. Soil is alive, bursting with energy, and teeming with an ecology, botany, entomology, and biology all through it, and a rich and interesting geology below it. Without good topsoil, we don't eat. Soil is so cool that it has its own classification system and survey. Soil is alive and vital and incredibly underrated. It even has its own league of experts. In addition to biologists studying what's in it and geologists studying what's below it, pedologists and morphologists study the formation and classification of it. Someone concerned with soil as a medium for plant growth might be called an edaphologist or an agronomist. Others studying soil are classified by their disciplines. Soil chemist, soil physicist, soil biologist, or microbiologist. Our topic for today, and to borrow loosely from Mick Jagger, is sympathy for the soil, the hidden and critical role of the fascinating world under your feet at this very minute. Our guests today are Drs. Caitlin Campbell and Debbie Hanmer from the biology department, and Dr. Darren Nelson from geology and geography. Debbie, take our listeners deeper into the science of soil. What's in it, what's below it, and why does it matter?
Well, we wouldn't be here without the soil. That's why it matters. One thing that most people don't understand about the soil is it's really a living thing, and it responds to its environment. So if you can imagine a single teaspoon of soil will have over a billion organisms in it. Now, these are tiny organisms. They are bacteria and fungi, but there are also many other organisms that live in the soil. There are amoebas, there are insects, there are mammals, there are reptiles. There's all kinds of things that live in the soil, and they make a community. And that community is actually very interconnected with each other, and they provide important roles for us in how they shape the soil. Let me give you one example. If without that very integrated community, we would not be able to have the plants that we so depend on, not only for the beauty they provide, but of course for food for us to eat. Now, it turns out that the only thing that a plant can absorb from the soil has to be in very, very small molecules, like a nitrogen ion or a potassium ion. It can't absorb anything like an organic molecule that's larger in size. So plants are totally dependent upon the community that is in the soil to take the leaves that fall off of the tree and decompose it and break it down into the tiny little molecules that the plant can then use. So no soil, no organic community, no plants.
Anybody have anything to add?
I would add that as a geologist, we think of soil as what we call the critical zone. I don't know if anybody else here has ever heard of the critical zone, but we think of the critical zone as the top of the canopy of trees all the way down to bedrock. And that is where the water and the air is interacting with the rocks themselves to extract those nutrients that we have every single day for the animals and from also just as water filtrates through that soil and takes out the contaminants and puts it downstream. So.
See, I knew soil was underrated.
It's where all life is.
Absolutely. Caitlin, how does the soil ecosystem in a given area change over time?
Well, a lot of habitats go through various processes that are called succession. So maybe there's some big disturbance that occurs in a habitat and the soil gets disturbed in some way. For example, a large fire sweeps through or plowing or tilling your soil. Or maybe there's a big volcanic eruption and now you got to start from scratch on your soil. Because the soil is a living thing. And every time you set it back or remove some of the biotic components, the animals and the plants from that community, it's going to change the soil system. One of the things that I study are insects and how they affect and how the soil affects their biodiversity. My specialty is actually on ants and mites. And ants and mites, a lot of them are very specialized on soil communities. The ants that I studied for some of my PhD work were found in prairie systems that had been restored from agricultural land. So through the Conservation Reserve Program, farmers are actually paid not to plant their crop and instead are paid to plant a prairie or native system instead. And what we can do is we can look at those systems and see how they change over time by looking at different ones that are different ages. How long have they been in the program? And what I saw when I was doing some of my work is that the ant species would totally change. In the very young prairies, it'd be the things that you basically find in a cornfield. Maybe just a couple species of ants were found there. And the soil was much denser, and it was there's very little organic matter or the carbon and stuff that's been broken down. And then as you move through the community later and you look at these older ones that have been established for a while, like 10 years or 7 years even, you see that the ant community has grown dramatically, and now there's maybe 10 species of ants that live there, and they're all doing different things in that habitat. Some may be specialized on moving around plant seeds and dispersing them to new locations, and others can be making huge mounds that really influence the soil quality by turning it under more. And the same thing happens actually for the mite communities. You can see that more mite species appear as the site gets older and develops more. So, the soil can really change a lot over time, and it just has to do with how long you kind of leave it alone and allow it to recover from disturbances, or if you're always setting it back through continued disturbances, that can really change the trajectory of diversity in that habitat.
So I have this image in my head that there's a gazillion things going on in soil at any possible second that you would look into it, and they all seem to affect and react against each other.
Definitely. And some things, have tracking trajectories where they're kind of responding in similar ways, and other things will respond in different ways. Like, so those ants that would be present in the cornfield and were also present in the very young prairies, those ones kind of disappear over time. They're not there in the later communities, and you get more specialist species showing up instead that are actually native to prairies.
There's over 7 billion humans on the planet. Talk about the ways in which human life positively and negatively affects soil habitat.
Well, I can address that question. My area of specialty is sustainable agriculture. And, of course, humans have been doing agriculture now for over 10,000 years. And as you can imagine, agriculture has huge impacts on soil. One of the things that we don't think about is that soil has the capability of storing a lot of carbon. And carbon, of course, is the problem with too much. Climate change is the problem with too much carbon in the atmosphere. Agriculture actually is a significant contributor of carbon to the atmosphere. Every time you plow a field, what that does is it stirs up all of those communities. It really messes them up. And it incorporates extra oxygen into the soil. And what happens is the microorganisms all kind of go crazy and they start decomposing and eating up the organic matter that is in the soil, and that ends up releasing carbon dioxide into the air. So every time a farm, a piece of land is tilled, some of the organic matter that's in that soil ends up in the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. Okay, so that's the bad news. The bad news is that agriculture releases, and the way that we do most of our agriculture right now, releases a lot of carbon dioxide into the air. The good news is that soil stores carbon, and there's a lot of soil out there, and we can store a lot of carbon in the soil much less expensively and more efficiently than, say, some fancy plant whose job is to pump carbon dioxide under the ground or something like that. And the way that you do that is that you do a number of different techniques which help you to increase the amount of organic matter that's in the soil. One example is every time the soil is completely bare, remember that community. And when the soil's completely bare, there's nothing there feeding that community. So the plants that are on the surface of the soil release a lot of sugars into the soil that actually feeds the organisms in the soil. When you remove those plants, then they have nothing to eat. And so you're going to change the makeup of that community. So one thing that's relatively easy to do is to be sure that the soil is never completely bare. And so you do that by having cover crops and adding cover crops, not leaving the soil bare, is going to increase the amount of carbon that's stored in the soil and decrease the amount that's actually being released.
That's not how we got kudzu, is it?
Kudzu was introduced as a way to try to reduce the amount of erosion because it's so effective at covering a hillside. And it does do that.
But not for a farm use.
Yeah. One of the other things that we're doing that will help to sequester carbon in the soil is something called rotational grazing. And so in rotational grazing, what you do is you try to mimic nature. And if you look at, you know, pictures of the Serengeti in Africa, the herbivores, the plant-eating animals, are all in herds. They run around in clusters close together. And the farm can recreate that. And what you do is you basically have the animals in a relatively small area, and you move them on a frequent basis, either every day or every other day. And you basically move them to a new piece of the pasture, and you let the place where they were just at simply rest, incorporate the plant material that's been pushed in by animals' feet. And anyway, you keep moving them, and what that does is increase the quality of the soil in that. I'm just going to leave it at that, I think.
I have something else to add. One of the things that's really been picking up in the agriculture, industry is doing conservation till or no-till practices. So if you aren't going to do a cover crop or something, another option is to do the conservation till no-till, where you're going to leave the crop residue behind from the fall after you harvest, and it'll kind of protect things from the erosion problems where you're going to lose soil, and it's also going to leave some of the nutrients behind from those plant bits that are left there. So that's another way to protect your soil from being bare.
Mm-hmm. I would add on to that is my expertise is more in the water side of this, and they're going to a lot of places to drip systems instead. That reduces a lot of the erosion there, but also a lot of communities are starting to pump groundwater because the surface water uses are usually either sometimes contaminated or actually not available in some places. So they'll pump the groundwater. The problem with groundwater lots of times is it has higher total dissolved solids. Mm-hmm. When you put that onto the soil, those total dissolved solids will now get concentrated in the soils, and you start actually salinating your soils over time. Mm-hmm. And so if you're using too much of the deeper water, you can actually ruin the soil by using too much groundwater. But at the same time, if you use pesticides on your crops, and then those pesticides are on your crops, the rain calls down, and then it goes back into the soil that will then end up into the groundwater or even into the rivers that they actually come into. So there's a lot of problems with that as well. In other localities, I come from the western United States where we have a lot of more arid environments. You look at the Colorado River, it's brown for a reason. There's lots of soil. A lot of the farmers there actually are doing surface irrigation. All that soil gets makes it up into the river. But they pump it back right up into the farms, goes back into the river. By the time it gets down to the Mexico, it's now saline. Water, so they cannot actually, it's now salt water or brine at that point. They have to actually pay millions of dollars every year to clean that up just to send it through to Mexico. And then it doesn't even end up into the ocean. So it doesn't matter either way. So, but yes, we have huge impacts on our soils and how we actually manage our fields and in agriculture and other uses as well.
We'll return to 30 Brave Minutes in a moment. But first, thank you for listening and for your financial support of the College of Arts and Sciences. Please consider a contribution to the Arts and Sciences Dean's Fund. The fund exists to help students and faculty make meaningful connections to the community, the state, and beyond through intellectual inquiry, scholarships, and research in the humanities, social sciences, and STEM fields. Consider a contribution today. Mark your envelope to Dean's Fund, College of Arts and Sciences, UNCP, Hickory Hall, Pembroke, North Carolina, 28372, or call the College of Arts and Sciences at 910-521-6198. You can also find us on the web. And now, back to 30 Brave Minutes and your host, Jeff Frederick.
Hey, Debbie and Caitlin have described this massive ecosystem in the soil and all these plants and animals and liquids and solids and really cool stuff going on. How does all of what's happening in the soil up top affect the geology below it? And how does the geology below it in some extent affect the soil above it?
It's usually the other way around. It's usually the geology below it is actually impacting the geology on the top because most of the soils are actually broken down rocks and material that were there in the first place. As the water seeps down, it's actually chemically weathering over time, and therefore you have your different horizons of different soils. You have your organic horizon, your B horizon, C horizons, all those different ones where the different nutrients are concentrated. And so if you have a sandy soil like we do around this neck of the woods, lots of silica, you're going to have a lot of the water can filter through it quite well. You're going to have the water seep down and start getting clay layers further down as it concentrates in those regions. And so whereas if you have, for example, areas that have lots of iron, I need to not use technical terms here, iron-rich soils, then you're going to get different kinds of plants, different kinds of organisms living in those soils. In our areas where we have lots of silica-rich, you can also have different plants in different soils because the plants, the sand that we have here is mostly from old beach deposits. That was when the sea level was really high. And so all of our soil is mostly very silica-rich, and therefore doesn't hold as much of the nutrients as some of the other soils do. They're usually poor soils because of that sand.
I can speak to that, too, in terms of how the geology of an area affects the biodiversity in the area. I'm actually originally from Ohio, and in Ohio we have different zones that were glaciated and not glaciated. And the soils there can be really different because in the glaciated areas they're more young soils. The unglaciated areas are very old soils that have been there for a long time. They have, different sort of nutrient properties and also different, textures and things like that. And in some of the, glaciated and unglaciated areas, you have totally different biodiversity occurring there in terms of plants, but also like the insects underground and things like that. you know, my specialty is ants, so I like to talk about ants a lot. With the ants, even around here, we have different soil textures, and there's different textures, you know, with different elevation as well. And ants are very sensitive to that, and you'll find just certain species that are found in different sort of soil, like how sandy it is, will determine how many fire ant mounds you might find in an area. And, you know, other species are very specialist on things, and they can't have a lot of sand in an area.
So I'm gonna go off that because I do geological mapping often in Western United States, but I actually use ants to figure out what's underneath my feet. Mm-hmm. So I'll go to ant hills and actually tear the ant hills apart. I know, sorry for the ants, but
very politely though. Right?
So very politely, that's
they'll
right.
Fix it.
I'll go through there, tear it apart because what I see there will then be inducive of what's underneath my feet because yeah. they bring up that sediment to the top, and I can actually understand the different soils in the region because of that. But I also look at plants. Because different plants will grow in areas that are clay-rich, other areas are sand-rich, and other areas that, like sages, have to go down further for their water table. So I can actually map out soils in a region by just looking at the plants, looking at the animals, and not even digging down beneath my feet because of the organisms that are on the top.
So both ants and plants are sort of miners of a sort. They're digging down deep into the soil and then bringing up some of what they've churned up from below.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. So soil is just this incredibly resilient material, is it not? Animals and plants are constantly being introduced or taken out of the system. We're constantly adding pesticides or fertilizers to try to get more or less of something going on, and yet the soil just tends to keep on ticking. Why is that?
Well, I think it does wear down over time. And, you know, some areas have very, like soils that don't really have much, you know, exchange capacity with different nutrients anymore. I don't know a lot about the whole process of soil aging, but I know they do age.
I would say that your climate has a lot to do with it. Areas that you have what we call aerosols, which are your arid environments, their soils are very, very thin. And you can go down a couple inches and you're no longer in soil anymore. Whereas you go into areas around here where we have, can't remember it because I'm trying to think of it, but where we have much more humid environments, we have much thicker soils. Just because of the difference of the climate. And so depending on where you are in Ohio, you're going to have a lot of different soils than you're going to have here. And so it really is based off of climate and the rocks underneath your feet of what kind of soils you're going to get. So,
well, let's talk a little bit more about the stuff that's underneath us. Things die. They decompose in the soil. And over the fullness of time, some sense of these fossils creating fuels or other things that we extract happens. Darren, tell us a little bit about the geology and, to some extent, as well, the biology of the process of how fossil fuels get made.
Fossil fuels are often not being developed, first of all, in soils. Okay, they're usually in deep water environments. You're having sediment coming out of the ocean, settling down on the bottom of the seafloor, but also at the same time, with those sediments, you have different organisms that are actually settling out with it. And over time, as more and more of those sediments and organisms actually fall down on the ocean floor, they will stack up. Start to compress down on those organisms, and then you start having your fossil fuels starting maturating at that point. It's starting to heat up and starting to be extracted from that organic material. That's more like what you call in your oil, right? And you can get natural gas from that as well. That's just a byproduct of oil. It's just a different maturation states at different temperatures. As you get more higher temperatures, you're going to get more natural gas. Lower temperatures, you're going to get more crude. But then you can also get things such as, which would be more considered closer to soils, which is coal. And that's all the organic material that actually is composed of from plants, much like our Carolina Bays around here. All those organic material gets stacked up, compressed over time. much of the fluid gets out of it, and then you can start burning that organic material for fossil fuels at that point. So it's usually over long term. I mean, we're talking millions of years that these things actually occur. We call fossil fuels a non-renewable resource on purpose because in our time frame on this planet, they will not renew. They are renewable, but not in our time frame.
It's got to take a really long yes. view of things, don't you?
Absolutely.
So. You mentioned earlier a little bit about soil erosion. Talk about the effect that has on a given area, and how do scholars feel about reversing soil erosion or preventing it from happening? Talk a little bit about that process.
So soil erosion, of course, is really important in agriculture, and we have become very much aware of that in agriculture and how important it is. The Great Depression and Dust Bowl that occurred in the United States was the result of poor agricultural practices, and people understood that, and we actually started some things in the government to try to teach people how to farm in ways that would reduce the amount of erosion that was there. And so some of these practices that you see, if you've traveled, of plants being planted in bands across the side of a hill, that is to reduce the amount of erosion that occurs on that cropland when it rains. And so a lot of these different techniques have been incorporated into the way that people farm now. So hopefully we won't have another great Dust Bowl like we had, because people really are doing a better job of trying to control the amount of erosion. Now, having said that, there's still tons and tons of erosion going on, and we could certainly improve what we're doing.
I mean, there's multiple hundreds of different techniques to actually reduce soil erosion. You just talked about a couple of them. You talked about one just a while ago of no-tillage. Mm-hmm. That's a way to reduce actual soil erosion over time. You can do it through water erosion or through wind erosion. There's lots of times people will put out trees and line fields with trees, and that's to reduce wind erosion on the actual farms themselves. And so there's lots of different methods of that over time. And it's really just trying to retain the soil that you have for crop production or whatever you want to use for that soil over time. And so if you don't do that, just like at the Dust Bowl, which they were basically over-tilling, just using the same crop over and over again, and then not maintaining that soil over long terms, and then that soil was depleted over time and didn't have the nutrients that it needed to actually have long-term crops.
Yeah, I actually have an example of the conservation till no-till methods actually making a pretty big difference in a lake reservoir. There was a lake near where I grew up called Acton Lake, and it's pretty big. It's entirely surrounded by agriculture almost, and they've been measuring the amount of sediment coming in and the amount of nutrients and all these different, you know, parameters for a long time there before they started instituting the no-till in the area and after, too. And what they could see is a dramatic change in the amount of nutrients going into that lake and also the amount of sediments that it was more clear than it had ever been before. And, you know, that can make a big difference. If you have too many nutrients going into a lake, that can result in bad algal blooms, where the algae just go crazy and they reproduce really fast. And then what happens is they don't live very long, and the decomposers are going to break them down, and they're going to suck up all the oxygen in the process of that breakdown. And that results in places where fish can no longer swim. They're called dead zones. So, you know, the issue of erosion can be pretty serious, and it's, you know, partly that it's pulling away the soil, but it's also pulling away all the nutrients involved with the soil.
Well, thanks for a lively and interesting discussion. I want to thank Drs. Caitlin Campbell and Debbie Hanmer and Darren Nelson for their insights on the topic of soil. Thanks to all who are listening today. Please pass this along to others who might get a kick out of some thoughtful conversation. And see you next time for 30 Brave Minutes.
Today's podcast was produced by Richard Gay and transcribed by Janet Gentis. Theme music created by Riley Morton. This content is copyrighted by the University of North Carolina at Pembroke, UNCP, and the College of Arts and Sciences. It is to be used for educational and non-commercial purposes only, and is not to be changed, altered, or used for any commercial endeavor without the express written permission of authorized representatives of UNCP. The views and opinions expressed by any individuals during the course of these discussions are their own and do not necessarily represent the views, opinions, and positions of UNCP or any of its subsidiary programs, schools, departments, and divisions. While reasonable efforts have been made to ensure that information discussed is current and accurate at the time of release, neither UNCP nor any individual presenting material makes any warranty that information presented in the original recording has remained accurate due to advances in research, technology, or industry standards. Thanks for listening to 30 Brave Minutes, and go Braves!